It is easy for one of you to spring a query on one of us who is bent on giving you some message, and whose will is all taut and strenuously focused on that message he wishes to give. It is not so easy for us, who have other work on hand, and who live in the present so much, to make a sudden about ship and sail for the one little section in our wake where a particular wavelet lapped our bow, and which has long ago flattened out upon the bosom of the ocean. The while the ship still sped on her way, breasting swell after swell of the ocean. Count each swell a century, and you will get some idea of my meaning. And now, friend, our narrative must await our next coming to resume it and to tell you some little more of Mary and Joseph, angel commissioners of God. So, Arnold. And next headline is. And next headline is. Note: the manuscript of sittings between February 15 and February 22 was unfortunately lost with other manuscripts relating to messages following the sittings of January 18, 1918. See Chapter 9 of Volume 3. Stillborn Children. Friday, February 22, 1918. What we have to tell you tonight will, perhaps, seem a little off the track of our narrative. But it is necessary to readjust your outlook in respect of a matter of some importance to those who would try to understand the differences which obtain in the life of these spheres as compared with your normal earth life. We speak of childbirth into these realms of those who come forth from the earth sphere but have not been endowed with a separate individuality therein. 3. These children come here asleep, and you will realize that their first awakening is that process here which answers to birth on earth. They have never breathed the atmosphere, nor seen the light, nor heard any of the sounds of earth. In brief, none of their bodily senses have been exercised in the way for which they were prepared by their natural formation. The organs of these senses are, therefore, nearly, but not quite, perfect in their structure. Moreover, the brain has never been called upon to interpret their messages. And so the child of earth lacks earthly qualities empirically, while having them potentially. These conditions do not apply to a child who has been actually born into earth life, even though he has but a few moments, or even less, of life before he passes on here. The problem, therefore, which they have to solve who take these children in hand is not a small one, for it is necessary both that the organs be dealt with so that a natural progress may attend the child, and also that the brain receives its lesson. 4. In the case of an infant a few minutes old, this connection between the brain and the organs of sense has been established and can be used in the maturing of those faculties dependent for their exercise on those organs. But a stillborn child does not have that connection, and it has to be made on this side. Once that is done, the progress is merely a matter of orderly development, on the same lines as that of ordinary children. To this end, several means are pressed into use. There is the relationship between the child and his parents, and especially between him and his mother. He is brought into contact with her in such a way that he experiences what is as nearly as possible equivalent to birth. By this process, he is made to feel his separation from her bodily, his individualization as a separate and complete entity. This is achieved not by his taking a body of flesh, but by his being brought into intimate association in his spiritual body with the spiritual body of his mother. This does not affect so perfect an inception of contact between brain and organic faculties as does a natural birth, but it does establish in a definite way the relationship of earthly parenthood, and from that time the child is kept in touch with his mother in order that he may, as he grows up to maturity, be as others, so far as it is possible to achieve this. Still, there is always some little difference between such children and those others who have been born on earth. They are lacking in some of the sterner virtues, and, on the other hand, they are more spiritual in their personality and outlook. But as earth-born children progress in spiritual development, and the stillborn children develop their knowledge of earth by contact with their mothers, and later with their other relatives, so the difference is minimized until they are able to associate on quasi-equal terms of loving friendship, and to help in the mutual giving of what each lacks. So the earthborn are mellowed in sweetness, and the others are strengthened in character, and, both being included in a community, infuse an element of variety which is as pleasurable as it is a profit. You will see, my son, by what I have now told you, how great is the responsibility of earthly parents to those of their offspring in these realms, for association with them is necessary to the true development of the earth-born children also. It is not an adequate life they lead if they are not kept in touch with their kin on earth. There is a hiatus which no one else can fill. And where the parents are of evil life, it is necessary that their spirit children be held aloof from their company for many years of earth time, until they be grown up and of such strength of will and quality of wisdom that they may help the guardians of those people in their watch over them for their well-being. And most often this development is not sufficiently advanced that it be safe to expose the child to earth influences before the time of earth probation is over and the parent is called away to these realms of spirit. In such cases the only help the child can give is that of prayer. Such a parent comes over here either with no affection for the child she has suckled at her breast, or else with no knowledge that the child exists at all. So the link between them, weak at best, grows weaker still as the child progresses upward, and the mother goes downward to her own place of purging. And by the time she has again ascended to the sphere where the child had awaited her coming all her earth life through, he has gone onward into the upper realms and is out of reach of her. He may be cognizant of her, and send her his help unknown to her. But the link of warm love which should be about parent and child to bind them heart to heart is not, and never can be, in the ordinary progress of heavenly life. I have told you this, my son, because we here have noted so much disregard among you of the burden of motherhood in the matter of which I speak. And yet these sweet flowers, plucked before the bud be open fully to life's sunlight, be so beautiful, and their wistfulness at the lack of their own parentage so marked, it fills one with great distress to see it so. Not that they be in any way unhappy. We would not permit that to be. But there is a lack, as I say, and it is only partly supplied by those dear mothers who lacked the achieving of motherhood on earth, and find it here. So each, you will note, makes a gift to the other of what that other lacks, and receives what is wanting in return. And it is very beautiful to see. But, Arnold, why have you inserted this essay in this place? It seems to have no connection with your narrative. But yes, my son, I have noted that query forming in your mind as you have written, and knew you would ask it of me in due time. And it was not without intent that I chose my theme tonight. For without such knowledge it is not possible to understand the Queen and her consort, whom you have named Mary and Joseph. It is of their relation in the long, long past that I have told you tonight. So first they came together. The fruition of their love bond you have seen. Arnold. And next headline is. And next headline is. Chapter 3. The University of the Five Towers, Tower of Angelic Life. Friday, March 1, 1918. There is in the sphere 10 a vast glade in the middle of a forest. It is surrounded by the forest, from which there emerge into the open many roads which lead away into different quarters of the sphere. From these the branch off paths in all directions, which are much affected by those who draw aside from the company of their fellows for meditation, and for communion with those in other spheres. Beautiful is the peace which here prevails. The trees and flowers and the streams, a lake here and there, with the birds and forest animals for only company, entice the student to wander here and drink in its atmosphere of peace. But our present business is in the glade. It is so great in area that you would perhaps name it plain. It is filled with gardens and fountains and temples and buildings put to the use of study and research. It is a university, but of such a plan that it might stand for a city beautiful. For in motive here beauty seems to rank equal with knowledge. It is not circular in shape, but rather oval. At one end of the oval the projects from the forest edge a high broad porch, flanked with trees on either side, and above the trees there appears a wing of the building, with a balcony running high up the wall, and giving a view far over the glade. The remaining building is embosomed in the forest, except the towers and dome, which you see soaring above the porch and beyond it. Were it not for these, you would not know there was a large group of buildings there, so thick are the trees about it. There are five towers, four of equal size, but not of equal pattern and, in their midst, the dome. The great tower rises farthest away, and is continued to a great height, ending in a very beautiful design. This cap is in the form of a heavenly palm tree, whose leaves are interwoven in filigree to form a crown set with jewels and surmounted with a semblance of a constellation of suns, also bejeweled richly. All this, the four towers, the dome, and the great tower, has a mystical significance, which only those who have passed into the temple of the Holy Mount do fully understand. These explain to the students of the university so much as they are able to assimilate on the occasions of a great festival, and some of the mysteries of that place are explained by manifestation. Of one such occasion I will tell you, but will first be a little more comprehensive regarding this building itself. Beyond the porch there lies a lake which is approached by steps onto which the porch gives, and which stretch to some distance right and left. The main building rises from the lake, and all its gardens and the clusters of lesser buildings are joined to it by bridges, mostly with roofs. The dome covers a hall which is used for observation. This work is not like that carried on in the wings of the Temple of the Holy Mount for sending help and maintaining communication, but for the simple study of the spheres. This study is elaborated, by classification, into a science which is continuously progressive, because the spheres are forever readjusting themselves in their relation each to the others. So there is no finality in the pursuit of knowledge in these heavenly realms. The four towers have each a group of buildings of their own. I cannot give you their names, but you may write them down as the Tower of Sleeping Life, which you would call mineral, the Tower of Dreaming Life, which you would call vegetable, the Tower of Waking Life, which you would call animal, and the Tower of Consciousness, which you would call human. The great tower is the tower of angelic life, which watches over all those forms of life below it in degree of progress, and also crowns them all. For towards the angelic order is all the lower creation moving. These towers are served by the house of the dome, and to it they turn for any specific item of knowledge they need in their work of research and classification. On the powers generated within the dome house they rely to help them in that matter. The four towers are each of different design, and you would know at once, as you looked at them from the plane, what order of creation they were intended to reflect. They are designed to that end. The work going on within them infuses them each with its own peculiar character, and from that infusion the design emerges and becomes the pattern outwardly displayed. The great tower is very lovely to see. It is of no color of earth, but call it golden alabaster set about with pearls, and you will get an idea of it. It is almost like a vast and splendid fountain of liquid gems in perpetual play, but instead of the splashing of waters, there is given off a harmony of whispered music, so that none can approach that building but be moved, almost to enchantment of ecstasy, by the influence it sends abroad. The waters also are beautiful, for they wind in and out of the flower gardens, and here is a narrow stream, and there a lake in which the towers, or dome, or some gem of architecture, is reflected, and lies in placid, restful beauty, like an angel child in its cradle, so to describe it for you. I will take you within the great tower and note a few of its qualities. This has no broad building at its base, but springs straight up from its foundations. We stand within and look upward, and you are struck at once with awe. There is no floor or roof between you and the sky above. Up and up and up ascend the walls. It is square like a mountain precipice, until the top seems set right into the heavens among the stars. Far away the rim of the tower appears, almost beyond the tower itself, so high is it. But the walls are not blank. The tower is built of double walls, and on all four sides there are rooms and halls and dwelling places of the angels. So as you gaze aloft you see here a doorway, there a balcony or a hanging window, or a bridge will shoot from one dwelling to another, in a curve outwards over space, and inwards again to its destination. Or a diagonal line on the wall will show where a flight of steps goes from one house or source of pleasure to another. Even gardens are there, planted on broad ledges thrust out from the walls of the tower. And so high and so wide is this great shaft that, those items, which are of roomy proportions when you reach them from within, yet they do not impede the view into the sky above, nor alter the contour of the opening at the top. And as you look about, you see how the light alters and blends, or grows or dies away at different parts of the ascent. So, at one home, as it leads onto the well of the tower, there seems to be shining the noonday sun. On another, the evening sun seems to be setting and lighting up the ledge garden, with its lovely green trees and arbors, with a sunset glow. At another part of the structure there is an aspect, yes and a sense, of sunrise on a fresh spring morning, with the singing of birds and the ripple of mountain streams into the meadows below, for running water is not absent here in this wonderful place. Music, also, from one dwelling or another comes sometimes from several at one time, and yet the interior of the building is so vast that they do not invade each the theme of the other's melody. Now, from what I have told you, and that is but a little of the whole, you might deduce that you were in some place where slumber was chief resident, and ease the motive of its founding. But cast back your mind to the name I gave these five towers, and you will see that such is not the case. This great tower supervises the work of the other four, and the dome draws from here the power required for its work. Here reside angels of great rank, and come and go from very high realms to give of their mighty strength and far-flung experience, to aid those who now seek to tread the way they went before ages ago. Those whose abode is in the four towers and the dome house are doing, in the present eternity, what they themselves did in eternities bygone, whose denizens have passed on in the cycle of progress, and left their place to be possessed by the present race. You will note also that, much advanced as their work is, yet it is still of the fostering, and not of the creating, of things, being still in sphere 10, but it leads on there, and this is one of the places highest in degree, in sphere 10. Did you pass through that university, Arnold? Yes, I took my course through all the four towers, that is the usual way. And the dome house? That I did not enter as student, having done such work elsewhere. I passed from the fourth tower into the service of one of the princes of the Tower of the Angels. It was he who trained me to proceed to the temple, and he also, as I have found since my return, sent of his power to help when I went about the darker places of the hells. He did this auxiliary to that of others, whose proper work it was. God's blessing, my son. Arnold. And next headline is. And next headline is. A manifestation in the Palm Crown Hall. The Christ Creative. Arnold's Earth Life. Monday, March 4, 1918. Within the precincts of the University of the Five Towers there is much movement but no hurry. Along the canals boats are issuing from the lanes which lead into the central waters, and are giving up their voyages upon the landings about the various buildings. Upon the terraces and stairways coming down to the water's edge thousands are congregating, and each group arriving adds to their gladness, for they bring with them an expectancy of some great manifestation. These have been called here each one personally. For not all the inhabitants of the sphere may come within these confines, but only those who are much progressed. The thousands being assembled, there comes from the Tower of the Angels a strain of music, and all are at attention to see what shall follow. I will describe this manifestation in sequence. As the music grew in volume, the atmosphere about the tower took on a certain mistiness, but did not obscure so much as transform it. It became more transparent, and seemed to be flowing up and down, and from within outward, and back inward upon itself, like liquid glass of many colors. Presently we heard voices above the angels' orchestra. They were singing a dumb, to the one alone, and to his Christ who was about to manifest some phase of his being to us. Could you give me the theme of their song? No, that is not possible. I will give you a version of it as well as I may. Here it is: we, who have listened to thy voice from afar, know thou art he from whom is melody, for, at thy word, eternities brought forth beauty. We who have seen thy face in his eyes, who alone has shown to us thyself, know that thou art formless, and yet out of thy mind came form, that beauty should not go naked, but be clothed in garments whose woof is light and their web the shadow. We, who have felt thy heart its beating, know that beauty is so formed for us because thou art all love and no love is but of thee. And of all thy beauty we can only know by the beauty of thy Christ, who shall manifest to us, thine offspring, in such form as thou hast given us to wear. We bow our heads to worship thee, for of thee we are, and ever look to thee, center of life and being. Behind this outer life thou hidest thine effulgence that it harm us not at all. Yet what thou mayest show us of thyself give to us now who wait his coming and his peace." The last words were slowly sung, with lingering cadence, and then all fell silent, and, with bowed heads, waited. Then we heard his voice saying, "Peace," and we raised our heads and saw that he was standing before the entrance of the Tower of the Angels. Before him stretched a long stairway, very broad, down to the water's edge, and, kneeling on the steps, were a great number of angels. They were the residents of the tower. They were many thousands in all. He stood alone, well away from the great round archway which gave into the tower, and, behind him, stood another multitude of angels of still higher degree, who had attended him on his coming. The tower now glowed like a great leaping flame, and flashed out its fire into the atmosphere until the waters flickered, shimmering like the tower, and seemed to be alight with its ardor. Then he raised one foot first, and then the other, and stood suspended. And we looked up to the tower top and saw that the crown was changed, for it was like a beautiful living thing now. The filigree work was all in movement, and, as we looked, we saw that the palm leaf crown was begemmed with clusters of angels. They sat in rows along the leaves, they stood in curves about the circlet at the base, they reclined upon the gem bosses. Every strand of the crown was a company of angels, and every jewel was a group of seraphim, glowing and burning like flames of fire. Slowly the whole tower top detached itself and moved forward into the space above the spot where he and his company stood. And then it floated slowly down until it rested upon the terrace pavement. Within were thousands of angels already, and we also were now instruced to cross the waterway and come inside. When I arrived at the stairhead I found a stream of people, lifted up in ecstasy of joy, pouring into the newly laid palace. And so I joined them and went within, nothing fearing, all was so calm and so full of peace and joy. Within, the crown was like a great hall, very high and glittering with precious stones and jewels from base to top. The open work was now filled in with a light suffused mist, which made the chamber self-contained. The walls went up vertical for a distance, and then arched over, joined, and met in the center at its highest span in one big jewel of sapphire color. This was transparent crystal, and had a wonderful quality of reflecting the heavens without, and showing who came towards the sphere and who departed. The crown must have been thus remodeled as it descended, for, at other times, it was quite open to the sky above it. How many were the present? I cannot say. But those who came with him must have numbered at least 1,500, and we guests were not less than 6 times that number. Then there were the residents of the tower, who were in number some 3,000, in ordinary. It was a great company. The object of this manifestation was one of instruction as to the science of that university. I have told you what it was. We had pursued our work of research, and had accumulated much material, and now he came to show us how it was coordinated with the knowledge of God as progressed into the spheres ahead. Could you be more explicit, Arnold, please? This is rather general. Yes, it is, my son, and I regret it much, but I fear I cannot make it much more simple for you. I will try. Not to weary you too much, at once I say, he came, at that time, as God his word made manifest. You know that the word it was who, when worlds were in the making, was constituted the medium by whom the energy of God's life became modified and condensed into that star milk out of which was churned plastic matter, and of this the worlds were modeled. The word was the agent of creation. The Father thought through the word, and his thought, in its passage through the word, took form of matter. This had been our study for a long time past, and it was to link us on initially to the kindred, but deeper, study of the realms above us that the Christ came now to explain to us a little more than we had learned of the Word in his relation to the work of the Father in the creation of the universe. But more than that I cannot transmit to you. Could you give me a description of him, as he came this time? He stood suspended in the midst of the palm crown hall, and so remained. I did not at first understand why this should be so. But as the manifestation proceeded I saw that any other position could not be in harmony with his theme. It was not merely a pose for the sake of teaching by the eye, It was by reason of his theme that he became levitated into space, and, as he proceeded, he arose until he stood the halfway between floor and roof. It is of the dynamics of these realms, not a matter of choice, but of scientific order. Moreover, the angels who had begemmed the crown without now were seen all around it, both on walls and the dome, within, living jewels to curtain the walls with living tapestry. You wish me to describe him to you? His robe was a tunic to the knees, of liquid green, his arms were bare, both of clothing and jewels. One jewel alone he wore. His belt about his middle was fastened by a clasp, and the clasp was a flashing blood-red stone. Midway between his hips it rested, and in that there is a mighty significance, if you will think it out. For, although he is never severed from the one of whom he came, yet in his work in these spheres away from the Father's presence his is truly a separation. He sallies forth, as of his own strength, to do battle with worlds, and must perforce turn away his face to do it. For his will must be projected outward from spirit into matter. That is the mystery of the ruby's emplacement. I would not have told you this, but I saw the question in your mind. He had no cloak. His legs were bare below the tunic, and his limbs and face were those of a young prince in full strength of youthful manhood. His hair was bare, parted in the middle, and fell upon his neck in clustering brown curls. No, I cannot tell you the color of his eyes, none you know. Your mind is full of questions of him, my son. I am trying to keep pace with you in this. Well, when you speak of him I always feel I want to know more of his appearance, as it may help me and others to know him better himself. I well understand. But, believe me, my son, you will come to know but little of all he is while you are in the earth sphere, and little more when you stand where I stand now, so great is he, so far ahead of any formula that your cramped theology of Christendom teaches. They have tried to catch and confine him in words and phrases. He cannot be so contained. He is free of the heavens of God, and the whole world is but a speck of dust upon the floor of his palace. Yet there be some of you who would not give to him the freedom even of that small atom. I will not pursue this further now. But, Arnal, what did you believe when you were here on earth? What you have just written, I believe. But did you, when you were here, sir? I did not, to my shame, for men had not then freed themselves from shackles of words, even so much as now they have done so. Yet, my son, believe me, I did go beyond my church's pale, and preached of love of wider scope than they would allow. And for that I suffered. They did not kill me, but they reviled me, and made me feel very lonely, more lonely at times than you do, my son. For there are more now to keep you company than there were to me. And although I did not reach so far as you do now, yet it was far to me in those dark days. The sun begins to warm the horizon today, my son. It was winter then. When was that, and where? It was in Italy, my son, in Florence the Beautiful. And I do not know when, but it was at the time when God was making things anew, and men were beginning to think strange bold thoughts, and the church frowned from one brow, and state frowned from the other. And well, I died in midlife and so escaped their further enmity. What were you? A priest? No, my son, no priest was I. I taught music and painting. They were oft mixed in one teacher in those early days. The early days of the Renaissance, do you mean? We did not call it so among us. But that was what it was, yes. God then began to make things anew as he is doing today. And when he stretches forth his hand to do so it means that men will have to help, with much effort. But they, in the work of renewal, are not alone. Mind you the ruby stone in his girdle, my son, and take heart by reason of his company. Arnal. And next headline is. And next headline is. The Manifestation, continued, Arnal's Earth Life. Friday, March 8, 1918. When we were all assembled, the angels who were his attendants lifted up their voices and led an anthem of praise, and we all joined them in their adoration. I see you wish me to give you the motive of the theme. It was as I write it now, being was, and from the heart of being came forth God, God thought, and from his mind the word became. The word went far abroad, but with him went God. For God was the life of the Word, and through the Word God's life passed onward into form. So man became in essence and emerged from his first eternity a creature of the heart and mind of God, and the Word gave to him the heart of angels and the form of man.